A carriage approaches to take you into the boundless realm of the supernatural.
Hello?
Moreno, the code word for the next shipment is elephant.
Oh, pish posh. We'll merely invite this lovely audience to be our guest for dinner.
I've got a whole new act for the 3D movie. Just wait here. I'll get him.
Okay, L.A., crank it up, because we're getting ready to rock on this exclusive live broadcast.
WDW Radio, your information station.
Hello, my friend, and welcome to the WDW Radio Show, your guide to the Disney parks, experiences, movies, and more. I am your host and your friend, Lou Mangiello, and this is show number 798. And for nearly the past 20 years, I wanted to not only help you have the best possible vacation experience when you go to the parks, but I also want to bring you a little bit of that Disney magic wherever you are. Here in the podcast, my weekly live video every Wednesday night, blog, events, weekly newsletter, and more. Please join the community and conversation and find everything at wdwradio.com. So this week, we're going to journey back in time to explore some of the attractions that defined our, my, Disney experiences. In this week's My 5 segment, I'm going to dive deep into the nostalgia of the past as I share with you my 5 attractions I miss the most, those iconic experiences that left an indelible mark on my, and maybe your, hearts and imagination. So join me as we take a trip down memory lane and revisit the magic that once was at Walt Disney World. And then, of course, want to hear from you. What Walt Disney World attraction do you miss most? Then stay tuned for our Disney Trivia Question of the Week and more updates at the end of the show. And don't forget to sign up for my free weekly email newsletter to stay connected and not miss a thing delivered right to your inbox with news, updates, events, content, and contests and more. And when you do, I'll also send you a free copy of my 102 Things to Do at Least Once in Walt Disney World book. You can connect with me on social. I'm at Lou Mangiello on Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn. And visit LouMangiello.com if you're looking for a speaker or if you're a creator, entrepreneur, or solopreneur looking to take your business, brand, or idea to the next level. You can find out some of the ways I can help you, we can work together, and about my Momentum series of events, including my weekend workshop this fall in Walt Disney World. We now only have 5 seats remaining, and you can still take advantage of the $200 off special by using code LOU200 at checkout. Again, to learn more, if you have any questions, reach out to me. You can visit LouMangiello.com. And if you like what you hear, and I hope that you do, please share the show, text it to a friend. So sit back, relax, and enjoy this week's episode of the WDW Radio Show. So my 5 this week, and first, thank you for the positive feedback on the first one I did a few weeks ago where I shared my 5 most memorable moments from D23 Expo. This week, I'm going to look to the past once again and once again be inspired by this year's non-Expo Ultimate Disney Fan event, because with progress comes change, and that change often brings loss, and that loss often brings sadness, and in some cases, a little bit of anger and outrage. Hi, internet, I'm talking to you. And look, while I understand and can appreciate the reasons behind change and progress, I get sad too. I am a sentimental, very nostalgic, very emotional guy who has very deep, deep roots in the parks going back to 1971. But fortunately, the one thing that can never be taken away and can never go away are our memories of attractions and shows and parades and characters and restaurants and even entire lands, birthday land, I'm looking at you. So this week, let's all take a trip down memory lane together as I share my 5 attractions that I miss most. None of these will include food, although I just had an idea to do my separate 5 foods in Walt Disney World that I miss most. I will add it to the list. But I'm going to relatively quickly go through these because I want to hear from you. What attraction do you miss most and why? You could post in the clubhouse. I would love it if you called the voicemail 407-900-9391. That's 407-900-WDW1, and I will play it on the air. Let your emotion and feelings come out as well. And this list has no order, other than how they came to me, I really didn't put, this is going to come out wrong, I really didn't put a lot of thought into this in terms of research. So it really is very subjectively and emotionally based in terms of how I came up with my list. So my five attractions that I missed most, number one, the very first one that came to mind was If You Had Wings.
If you had wings, you could do many things. You could widen your world if you had wings.
And now I can't get the song out of my head. This was actually not an opening day attraction. It didn't open until June 5th of 1972. And it was a very simple Omnimover attraction that was sponsored initially by Eastern Airlines to really sort of showcase this idea and excitement and really the ease of air travel, which I know in 2024 we take for granted. But again, this was the 70s and air travel, especially leisure travel, was something that was relatively new for a lot of people. So this was a living, breathing 3D advertisement for Eastern Airlines, which was the official airlines of Walt Disney World, and showed off a lot of their destinations that they served, like Bermuda, Mexico, and even New Orleans. It was a very slow-moving, very whimsical journey that used some set pieces and a lot of projection technology to create the feeling that you were literally flying through a number of these different locations. And I think for me, why this came to mind first was probably twofold. One, it was the music. If You Had Wings, You Could Do Many Things. It was written by Buddy Baker, lyrics by X Atencio. And two, when the park first opened in 1971 and for a number of years after, when they used A through E ticket books, each coupon would sort of be exchanged for an attraction, and A were some of the simpler attractions like an omnibus, and an E ticket were the big ticket attractions. If You Had Wings required no ticket, so you could ride for free, which maybe, I don't think it's why my dad liked it, but my dad loved this attraction and I loved riding this attraction with him. Not because it was free, not because it was air conditioned, but I can vividly remember those blue Omnimover vehicles. Think of a Haunted Mansion Doom Buggy, but in sort of a darker powder blue, riding that attraction with my dad and just finding it so simple and fun and funny. And I vividly remember some of the scenes, like being in the Caribbean and seeing the steel drum bands and the dancers and the crystal clear waters that were sort of projected on these huge walls. And my favorite scene, the one that still sort of pops into my mind when I think of If You Had Wings, was this fisherman in a shed that was showing off this fish that he caught to his wife. And as she's taking pictures of it and your vehicle goes by, the fish that is like hanging from a rope would shrink and grow to sort of exaggerate maybe his story or the photo, depending on where she was standing, of the actual size of the fish. I don't know why that continues to impact me many, many years later. Then I remember how it took us to San Juan, Puerto Rico. Yes, the song is still playing in my head. And the Bahamas, where a police officer was sort of directing a flock of flamingos and human traffic that's sort of crisscrossing in the street. Then there was Jamaica and Dunn's River Falls. And one of the other most impactful, and the technology is still there in Buzz Lightyear's Space Ranger Spin, or at least the attraction's there for a little while longer, was the speed tunnel. Where all of these scenes in, I remember they use like 70 millimeter projectors of like water skis and motorcycles and airplanes and trains sort of flying by us as if we were flying past or with them as well. And I remember like other details, like I remember the slogan of Eastern Airlines, the wings of man. Orson Welles actually did the narration in the pre-show, and I believe that was him saying it near the end of the attraction as well. And obviously I didn't realize it at the time that the attraction wasn't just an entertainment experience, but really a promotional tool for the airline. And for a little while, when you exited If You Had Wings, you didn't exit into a gift shop. You exited into a travel agency where you can ask and get more information about actually booking a trip to some of these locations. And I know somewhere in my closet garage archives, I still have my If You Had Wings Eastern Airlines wings, like that they would sometimes give you on airplanes. They would sometimes give that to kids and probably adults at the end of the attraction as well. And as I'm just talking and thinking out loud, I think the use of those Omnimovers and projection effects in that speed tunnel really helped to create a new type of immersive experience that showcased all of these different places around the world, really sort of maybe almost laying the groundwork for things like World Showcase and Epcot, where you couldn't just see it on a screen, but actually go and explore pavilions dedicated to different countries around the world. And this attraction, which sort of showcased the glamour and excitement and of adventure of air travel, closed just 5 years later to make way for a renaming of the attraction to become If You Could Fly, then being replaced by Delta Dream Flight when Delta took over as the official airline sponsor of Walt Disney World, which later became Take Flight, and then eventually Buzz Lightyear's Space Ranger Spin, and then eventually whatever may come next. And if you want to hear more detail about the history and the evolution of If You Had Wings, you can go back to show number 37, where I did a full retrospective on this attraction. But we keep moving forward. And the next attraction on my list also has to do a little bit with transportation and progress. And this next attraction, unbeknownst to me at the time, was actually a sequel to an attraction that still exists in Walt Disney World. I am, of course, going over to Epcot Center and a moment of silence for Horizons. And this attraction, which I covered very much in depth on show number 12, this is going back almost 20 years, show number 12, we did a full retrospective, and there's a great, not because it's me, but because he's great, and I did an interview with George McGinnis, who was one of the lead Imagineers and designers. Fascinating conversation with an incredible man back on show 27. But like If You Had Wings, Horizons was not an opening day Epcot Center attraction. It didn't open until exactly 1 year later, on October 1st, 1983. This too, I just realized, also an Omni-River dark ride that offered a glimpse not of current travel that you could take, like If You Had Wings, but a glimpse into the future in sort of this next step and evolution of not the speed tunnel, but other, at the time, groundbreaking technologies. And if you're wondering what attraction this is a sequel to, it's the Carousel of Progress, because this was designed to represent the future of not just sort of where we're living, like currently on planet Earth, but the future of human habitation and technological advancements on land, sea, space, desert, and undersea colonies, showcasing the possibilities of living together as a family, but in the future. And if you think about it, at the time, Horizons was unique in its approach because it really combined elements from a number of the other future world pavilions, communication, energy, transportation, imagination, into a single cohesive narrative, which emphasized this idea that if you can dream it, we can do it. And speaking of taking inspiration from other future world attractions and pavilions, like Spaceship Earth, the original version, that took us through this progression of communication technology, Horizons did the same thing with a sort of retro futuristic depiction of past visions of the future, like Jules Verne's From the Earth to the Moon, and other nostalgic looks into how people from the past envisioned the future, including like the late 19th, early 20th centuries. And then it transitioned into these windows into tomorrow and these futuristic environments that could or would be made possible by some of the technological advancements that were being showcased in other pavilions around Epcot. So you had the desert habitat, the undersea colony, a futuristic space station, and this urban habitat, this very sort of eco-friendly city of the future with vertical farms, automated systems, focus on sustainability. Literally, this attraction predicted where we are today. But the final part, and for me, my favorite part, in this unique Omnimover system where the front of the vehicle, like in the Haunted Mansion, didn't sort of tilt back towards you, but two doors sort of came together and met in the middle. And on those doors were little sort of touchpads, little screens that lit up, because the best part for me was the not just choosing your own adventure, but choosing your own tomorrow. You were given the option based on a majority. Everybody in the car, up to four people, could choose their own adventure. So using the buttons, you could select one of three paths for your return to the future port. You can choose space, a trip through a futuristic desert landscape, or a serene voyage through this undersea world. So there was a huge one rewritability factor, because what you chose literally determined what your final scene was. There was also the family argument factor, because maybe the kids wanted space, mom wanted the desert, dad wanted undersea. But I remember being with my family and sort of quickly voting on which one we wanted to choose. And for me, as I think back to this, there were a couple of things that really sort of stood out, right? Not just sort of the choosing your own adventure part. Certainly the music. If we can dream it, we can do it, which was not actually spoken by Walt Disney, but instead was written by Imagineer Tom Fitzgerald specifically for this attraction. But I also remember these two enormous OmniMax screens, very similar to IMAX, that were utilized to create this not just immersive, but almost sort of these wraparound visuals that were just on a scale that I had never seen before, really sort of making you feel like you were truly part of these very futuristic-like environments. And the other thing I liked about the attraction too, I probably didn't realize it at the time, is it does sort of follow in the carousel of progress, not just from a storytelling perspective, but I think Horizons really is an homage to Walt Disney, the man, and not just his ideas for Epcot, but as a futurist and his visions for the communities that we could create and live in together in the future. And I know I am not alone in my love and like missing of Horizons. So if everybody loved it and everybody missed it, why did it close? One, there was not always the longest line, which I think is part of the reason why some people loved it, because it was an omni mover. It was a very quick load. There was not usually a long line, but it did close on January 9th, 1999, not necessarily due to lack of interest, but there were a lot of structural issues with the building. I'm not saying it was sinking, but that lake in front of the Odyssey was not originally supposed to be there. Anyway, but there were structural issues. It also did lack a corporate sponsor after GE, who was also originally the sponsor of Carousel of Progress. Once their contract ended, this attraction was demolished to make way for Mission Space, which eventually opened in 2003. But for me, I think part of the reason why I love it, again, not just sort of thinking about very personal memories going with my family, but I think for me, the theme of Horizons, of optimism, of positivity, of innovation, and the potential, the nearly sort of limitless potential of the future, it resonates deeply with me. I think it resonates deeply with other guests. I am not the only person that misses Horizons so very fondly. And I think its continued popularity in terms of our sense of nostalgia and sentiment, it is not an accident that this year's D23, the Ultimate Disney Fan Event, the theme was called Horizons. And I think that 25 years after the attraction closed, I think to a certain degree, for those of us that grew up riding and loving and missing this attraction, Horizon still remains a bit of a symbol of the original spirit of Epcot, where the future is very optimistic and there are no limits to imagination and anything is possible. For number three on my list, we're going to go from the left brain side of Epcot to the right brain side, which is actually kind of true. Future World West was meant to sort of represent the more creative side, and the Future World East was a little bit more of the technological, logical side. But I do want to, I need to, I have to take you to the original Journey into Imagination.
One little spark of inspiration is at the heart of all creation. Right at the start of everything that's new, one little spark lights up for you.
And this is not the first that I shall pass this way, nor shall it be the last, because I talked a lot over the years about Journey to Imagination. I invite you to go back to show number 29, where I did my first retrospective entire show about this pavilion. But go back and listen to interviews that I've done over the years with folks who have been very much an integral part of the creation of the attraction and the execution of the attraction, including Tom Morris, Tony Baxter, Ron Schneider, the original Dreamfinder, Steve Kirk, a name you might not necessarily be familiar with, back on show 30. Fascinating, fascinating conversation about the genesis of this attraction, which again, did not open in 1982, but didn't open until March of 1983. And I'm going to try to not let myself go deep down this rabbit hole that I love so very much in terms of why this attraction meant so much to me as a kid. I still remember being at Epcot one time with my parents, and I remember telling my dad, I don't know how the conversation started, but I remember telling my dad, like, yeah, I love Epcot more than I love Magic Kingdom. And he looked at me like, you do? Like, how, why, like explain to me why. And I remember it wasn't just the technology, nerd alert. I've always been sort of a tech nerd since I was a little kid, but I remember specifically focusing on this original attraction. Quick side story. My son, who was born in 2005, obviously never got to experience the original attraction. Years ago, like pre-YouTube, I had a series of DVDs that had ride-throughs of the original attractions. And I had a three DVD set that had the original Journey to Imagination, the replacement Journey into Imagination with Figment, and the third version. And I remember all he wanted to watch was the first one. He didn't like the two iterations. I'm like, this is truly my son, because there was and will always be something special about this whimsical, innovative, dark ride that celebrated creativity in such unique ways and took us on this journey literally through this world of imagination that was guided by two beloved characters. The Dreamfinder, who was somewhat eccentric and but a little like this jovial inventor, and obviously Figment, who needs no introduction, who didn't just represent the spirit of imagination, but has over the years truly come to represent, literally and figuratively, the spirit of Epcot Center. And like Horizons, I think that there was something not just inspiring, but inspirational about this in terms of encouraging guests of any age to explore their own creativity and think outside the box. And whether it was science or art or literature or performing arts, which were represented through these beautiful, whimsical, elaborate sets with animatronics and special effects. And we'll get to the music. And once again, I seem to have a thing for Omnimover ride systems, the Omnimover vehicles, which allowed the Imagineers to literally direct where your attention would go by moving your vehicle around. But I invite you to go back and listen to the interviews with Steve Kirk and Tony Baxter about like this idea of how do you represent the concept of imagination in a physical, quantifiable form, and how this idea came to be and was executed. And we were brought into this world through the Dreamcatcher and this world of imagination with these different sections that were themed to represent different aspects of creativity. And I think for me, and possibly for you, and I know a lot of other people, I think this attraction was so beloved, not just because of the characters, right, who were created specifically for this attraction, for Epcot Center, but, you know, the technology that was used, right? At the time, things like fiber optics and projection mapping and even some of the animatronics to create this experience were unique and relatively cutting edge. Even I remember sort of the rainbow corridor at the end, and that when you walk through this tunnel of light in the post show, even that to me, I remember the pin table, we'll get to that. All these things were just fascinating. Like I could just ride this attraction, go to the post show area over and over again, because in this still beautiful and unique pavilion, we not only got to ride Imagination, Magic Journeys, and then later Captain EO was there, but the Image Works at post show area allowed us to interact with these very imaginative exhibits, like the Rainbow Corridor. There was a giant kaleidoscope, the Dreamfinder School of Drama, literally to let us, like other places like Communicore and Epcot, get hands-on with some of this technology, not for sort of the logical uses of it, but for the creative uses of it as well. And I think that's part of the, I think, again, this was sort of this perfect marriage of Sherman Brothers music, the technology, the storytelling, the characters, the interactivity that made this, at least at the time, and I think for many of us who look back on it so fondly, sort of the quote-unquote perfect attraction. And, you know, if you think that some of the recent announcements of some of the things that are closing and going away and making way are huge mistakes by Disney, it's not the first rodeo, because someone in their infinite wisdom said, you know, let's close this attraction in 1998 and replace it with Journey into Your Imagination, but let's take away Dreamfinder and Figment. Had there been the internet and social media of today back in 1998, I could not imagine the uproar, because I remember riding that with my dad. I remember coming down, we drove down from New Jersey, we rode it, and we looked, I can see it like it was yesterday, we looked at each other like, did I miss what? Did they take Figment? We need to ride that again. But there was this, like, this loss, like this disappointment. I was a little kid. I'm sure my mother went to guest relations and said something like, this is not the way Walt would have wanted it. But eventually they did listen and they did reintroduce Figment in a subsequent iteration called Journey into Imagination with Figment in 2002. I don't feel that same charm and magic of the 1983 version was ever fully recaptured. So again, like I've said, you know, about things that are going away now, we will always have the memories of these attractions, but it could never go back to being what it once was. Although I still believe, eventually I'm going to be right, I still believe that this attraction is due, dare I say overdue, for a reimagining, a reimagination of this pavilion, and who knows what this next iteration might be. Number four on my list, I just realized, is about to celebrate its 30th anniversary of its date of closure on September 5th, 1994.
This is the captain speaking. Welcome aboard. We are now underway and proceeding on a course that will take us on a voyage of exploration through liquid space.
When 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea took its final submarine voyage based on the 1954 film inspired by the Jules Verne classic novel, I'm going to do my best to not do my really bad Pete Renaday and or James Mason impressions, but you boarded this amazing replica of the Nautilus submarine, and I believed it at the time, literally went underwater to this voyage beneath the waves, encountering sea creatures and mermaids and, of course, the giant squid. This, too, also not an opening day attraction. It opened just under 2 weeks after the park did, around October 14th or so, 1971. But for little Lou Mangello, that when I climbed down into this not very accessible, very sort of narrow, steep staircase into the Nautilus, and I pulled down that red leather seat and stuck my head into my individual porthole, one of which I still have in my garage, I absolutely bought into it. I believe that when we were being submerged, even though the sort of just stay just below the surface of a show building designed to look like an open lagoon, it sort of had this bubble effect, but the bubbles and the sounds created this simple illusion of descending into the depths on our way to Volcania. I bought it. And I'm not going to let reality sort of cloud my memories of just how much I enjoyed that feeling, because this simple, serene underwater scenes of like fish and coral reefs and like happy little sea creatures became more adventurous and more mysterious as you hit like this graveyard of lost ships, and there was a giant squid and a sea serpent, and eventually you got to the ruins of Atlantis, which is something I was always been fascinated with since I was a little kid. And I can hear in my mind, like, the narration of Captain Nemo, who was voiced by Pete Renaday, who I interviewed on show 232 about this and some of his other work in the Disney parks. And I just remember, like, I think I posted this on social or maybe in one of my weekly newsletters. I have this picture of me trailing behind my mom, walking down into the sub, looking back up, presumably at my dad who was taking the picture. I have this big, stupid, not just hairdo, but this big, stupid grin on my face because I loved this attraction so, so much. This is one of the ones that I really, really do miss. And I, like current conversations that we are having, like, I understand why it had to go away. It was incredibly expensive to maintain, not just because of the upkeep of the subs and the complexity of the underwater scenes and the pneumatics and the animatronics and the high water table in Florida and the fact that it was very inaccessible to a lot of guests. Like, my mom had a tough time getting up and down those stairs. Often she would not ride, but certainly any guests with claustrophobic or mobility issues, et cetera, et cetera. And I remember when it closed in 1994, it closed like for a temporary refurbishment. It's that temporary refurbishment, it seems pretty permanent. It took like almost 2 years to finally announce that the attraction was not going to reopen. And so, like, I think they announced it like 1996 that it was never coming back. And that lagoon sat there until 2004. When it was filled to make way for things like Ariel's Grotto and the Seven Dwarfs Mine Train, sort of giving the ground time to sort of settle a little bit and then build things like the Seven Dwarfs Mine Train on top of it. For a while, it was Pooh's playful spot. It was a place where sort of a soft, padded area where kids can go and just burn off some excess energy, push that ground, tamp that dirt down one little footprint at a time. But I think, too, this is another one of those attractions that is very much beloved. And I think you can see that because some of the elements of the design and theming have influenced other Disney parks around the world, right? There's a version of the attraction with an updated storyline and technology in Tokyo Disney Sea. There is a Nautilus walkthrough, which is beautiful, in Disneyland Paris. It just got updated relatively recently. It's gorgeous. And I think you have to keep in mind, too, that at the time, this attraction was not just literally and figuratively immersive, because you were immersed into the water, but it was very ambitious. The ride technology at the time was very much cutting edge. The level and type of storytelling was very different than anything else we had seen in any of the Disney parks. And I think it did and continues to sort of influence Disney's approach to attraction and design and ride vehicle design, especially when you start thinking about sort of creating these truly immersive environments and experiences that transport guests to different places and different worlds. And I think that's part of the reason why the legacy and the memory and the emotion of this attraction lives on, not just in my, you know, little seven-year-old heart that experienced it, but in a lot of others who not only got to experience, but wish they could have. And certainly, yes, you can go to Disneyland and ride the Finding Nemo submarine voyage, which obviously replaced the 20,000 Leagues attraction in Disneyland, which, by the way, they had real mermaids, like real quote-unquote mermaids, sitting on rocks. I never got a chance to see it in person, but I've seen pictures, and I think it's fascinating. And number five, the final attraction on my list of five attractions that I miss most, is going to take us from the Earth to the Moon.
Our McDonnell Douglas flight to the moon takes place sometime in the future, when travel to outer space will be an everyday adventure. Ladies and gentlemen,
because when Santa Claus visited the Magic Kingdom on December 24th, 1971, he dropped off a present called Flight to the Moon, which eventually gave way to Mission to Mars. And this attraction, which sat in the Stitch's Great Escape show building, which currently houses a coming soon space, was this theater in the round attraction that simulated a mission to the moon. I remember entering the Mission Control Center, and then you go to this lunar transport where they would simulate this flight to the moon. There was this giant, like, circular screen on the floor, and there was one on the ceiling. There were audiovisual effects and motion seats. So when your rocket ship was taking off, you could see the blast of the flames below you, and you can see yourself approaching space above. I knew we weren't going to space, but I bought into it because it gave you this taste, this flavor, and the excitement and the wonder of space travel and what it would really feel like, minus the G-forces and the bad food. This was sponsored by McDonnell Douglas, so it made sense. It was a D-ticket attraction. I think it very easily could have qualified as an E-ticket attraction. And if you've heard the words, the name Tom Morrow, paging Mr. Morrow, Mr. Tom Morrow was the director of operations in the pre-show who explained everything going on in the Mission Control Center. So when you hear references to Tom Morrow, it began here in Flight to the Moon. And I can remember specifically not just the audio, right, the sort of almost spatial audio in the room, but as you sort of started the launch sequence, how your seats would vibrate. It was 4D before there was 4D to give you the sensation of a rocket taking off, right? You sort of watch the Earth like shrinking way beneath you, the same way as if you go up to Space 220 and you're in that sort of space elevator, that same type of experience, but on a much, much larger scale. And then you'd go up and you'd sort of orbit the Earth, and then you'd make your way to the moon, land on the moon, and then return to Earth. One of the things I distinctly remember was in the pre-show area, this bird that lands on like the launch pad or something, it sets off all of these alarms.
Clear all channels for possible emergency reentry.
Oh no, not again.
Stand by. Video signal coming in on all channels.
Just as I thought. Somehow, this silly bird trips the emergency system every time he comes in.
which if you go into the queue of Mission Space, there's actually a reference to that. It's silly, the little things that we remember from these attractions from so many years ago. But if you know the bird, you remember the bird, you love the bird. And if you do, please, like, let me know, call the voicemail or post. Let me know that I'm not crazy and that you remember the bird as well. But this attraction, like many, you know, it's the Tomorrowland problem with Tomorrowland. As time went on and travel to the moon became less sort of novel, and as space exploration advanced and the focus of the space program started to shift beyond the moon, the attraction sort of started to feel outdated. So it closed in 1975, was reimagined, reopened as Mission to Mars. Similar experience, new destination, updated theming. This attraction lasted until late 1993. Very similar experience, although Mr. Morrow was now replaced by Mr. Johnson in Mission Control. And we went to Mars instead of going to the moon. My memories seem to be more firmly planted in Flight to the Moon, although I do remember riding Mission to Mars, which was eventually replaced by the extraterrestrial alien encounter in 1995. Way more intense, way more thrill-based, not necessarily one for every guest. We do a very deep dive back on show 363. Poor Skippy. But anyway, Mission to Mars, again, this sort of final chapter in this space travel theme, which was part of Tomorrowland, not just since Walt Disney World's inception, but really this got its start in Disneyland's Tomorrowland as well, because eventually Disney replaces the focus on attractions like this to things like Alien Encounter, a little bit more interactive, a little bit more thrilling, trying to appeal to a newer, broader demographic as well. But I think for me and for a lot of other folks, this very much remains a nostalgic memory for those of us who visited Tomorrowland during the 70s and the 80s. And maybe as I think about it out loud, like this too, for me personally, also sort of reflects this spirit of exploration, the possibility of the future, this optimistic view of not just today and tomorrow, but the short and long-term future. That I think maybe was reflected of the optimism of the era itself, right? With this idea of human beings traveling to Mars seemed like that natural next step and progression from the moon landings, which had already happened. So that's it. That's my five attractions that I miss most. There are a number of other attractions that very easily could have made the list. The studio backlot tour at Hollywood Studios, the Hunchback of Notre Dame show at Disney's Hollywood Studios, I absolutely loved. The Great Movie Ride. And yes, I very easily could put Tom Sawyer Island on this list. Not because I have recency bias of everything else, but I will miss, and I do miss, I'm going to miss, the views and the sounds and the serenity, despite what some of you have said to me on social, because I do have fond memories of going there as a kid, and I do love what that space currently looks like now. I love being able to take my kids there, but as I explained on the recap show, I also can understand the logical and financial and forward and future thinking reasons why this Tom Sawyer Island and the attractions I just mentioned, which were very much beloved at the time, had to go away. Oh, I would also add to the list riding in front of the monorail. I just thought about that too. Talk about things that didn't cost anything. My parents just trusted me to do because I couldn't go anywhere. Riding in front of the monorail just for hours. I apologize to those poor cast members who I probably bored to tears with all my questions as a little kid. But riding in front of the monorail is something else. I will, it's those little simple things that we love and miss so much. But I want to know from you, what is your one or your five attraction that you miss most and why? I'll post this question over in the clubhouse at www.com/clubhouse. I'll also post it on social. Better yet, call the voicemail 407-900-9391. That's 407-900-WDW1. Let me know and I will play it on the air. Let me know the attraction that just hits you right here. I'm touching my heart. It hits you right in your heart and gives you all the feels. And let me know why, too. And as tempted as I am to sing it, just remember that if you had wings, you could do many things. You could widen your world if you had wings. Oh, now I can hear that exit narration. You do have wings. You do. You can do all these things. You can widen your world. Then that Eastern Airlines comes on. We'll be your wings. The wings of man.
For you.
It's time for our Walt Disney World Trivia Question of the Week, where I invite you to test your knowledge of Walt Disney World history or see how well you pay attention to the details in which you see, hear, taste, or remember. If you think you know the answer, you can enter for a chance to win a Disney prize package. Before we get to this week's question, let's go back, review last week's, and select our winner. So as we continue this theme of moving forward by looking into the past, last week I asked you to tell me what unique item used to be hidden on Tom Sawyer Island, which, if you found it and turned it into a cast member, you could exchange it for a prize. Thanks to so many of you entered, got this one correct, and some of you actually sent pictures of the paintbrush that you found on Tom Sawyer Island. This was this fun, somewhat little secret tradition that was such a surprise and delight moment for guests for many, many years. So what would happen is early in the morning before guests arrived on the island, cast members would hide a number of paintbrushes that looked like they had dried white paint on the end around Tom Sawyer Island, sort of evoking the scene of The Adventures of Tom Sawyer, where Tom fools his friends into painting the fence for him, which you could obviously find a reference to on the island itself. They were hidden throughout the island by the bridges, Aunt Polly's, Fort Langhorn. And if you found it, brought it to a cast member, you'd get a prize. And it changed over the years, but you'd get things like when they used to have paper fast passes, you can get a paper fast pass for yourself and your group. Sometimes it would be a little collectible sticker, etc. And this was very popular, and some people like that was, they would make the rope drop beeline to Tom Sawyer Island to try and be the first ones to find the paintbrushes. But don't go looking now, because unfortunately, this was discontinued without much fanfare back in 2013. And they never said why it was discontinued, although I have a feeling that at some point, some people started to find the paintbrushes and keep the paintbrushes instead of exchanging it for the fast passes. However, like many of the things we talked about this week and last week and with Tom Sawyer Island, this remains a fond memory for a lot of the people who had the opportunity to participate in this unique experience. Anyway, I took all the correct entries, randomly selected one. I never found a paintbrush, by the way, in all the years of looking. I randomly selected one. Last week, you're playing for a WW Radio keychain, stickers, pin, and a mystery item that I brought back for you from D23. And last week's winner, randomly selected, is Emily Bennett. So Emily, congratulations. I will get your prize package out to you right away. And if you played last week and didn't win, that's okay, because here's your next chance to enter in this week's Walt Disney World Trivia Challenge. So this week's trivia question is not about what is going away, but what is coming to Walt Disney World, because as we get ready, as we have been for years, for Villains Land to come to Walt Disney World, one of the literal and figurative biggest baddies is Chernabog from Fantasia. Now, I don't know if he's going to make his way into this new land or experiences, but he has been in Walt Disney World before in parades. What two Walt Disney World parades featured Chernabog, not in music, but actually represented in the parades? You have until Sunday, September 1st, how is it September already, at 11:59 p.m. Eastern to go to www.radio.com, click on this week's podcast, use the form there. Again, this week, you'll play for the same prize package, keychain, stickers, pin, and I brought back a lot of stuff from D23. You will get one of those mystery items. So good luck and have fun. Huge thanks to you for taking the time to tune in this and every week. Please let me know what attraction you miss most. Join the community and conversation over in the clubhouse. And if you're enjoying the show, and I hope that you do, please help support it for as little as a dollar per month by being a member of the WW Radio Nation. Your help not only brings the shows and live broadcasts to life, but you also get exclusive rewards like scavenger hunts, group calls, and surprise care packages from the parks. I have something super cool and unique going out to platinum members this month. Plus, you'll be supporting our Dream Team project, which has raised more than $500,000 for the Make-A-Wish Foundation. To learn more, to be part of the Nation family, you can visit www.radio.com/support. Please don't forget to join me this and every Wednesday night for WDW Radio Live on Facebook and on YouTube, 7:30 p.m. Eastern. You can find a link to both channels by going to wdwradiolive.com. I may be in a special location this week and may just have a special announcement on the live show as well. Please connect and chat with me on social. I'm at Lou Mangiello on Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn. And visit wdwradio.com or our Facebook page to learn more about our in-person events, including group cruises, Adventures by Disney, and Meet of the Month in Walt Disney World, as our next meet begins our farewell tour, not of the Meet of the Month, but of locations that may soon be making way for new attractions and experiences. Our next Meet of the Month is going to be Saturday, September 7th on Tom Sawyer Island, where we will meet over at Aunt Polly's dockside. We will say a fond group farewell to Tom Sawyer Island, chat, share stories, memories, maybe even take a group walk around and through the island together. And our next meet after that will be on Saturday, October 12th, this time at Disney's Animal Kingdom, as we say a fond, sad group farewell to Dinoland USA. We're going to meet at the outdoor seating area of Restaurantosaurus, talk about the attraction, maybe even take a group trip back in time to the Cretaceous period to get in, grab the Iguanodon, and get out before that asteroid hits. These meets are fun, free, family-friendly. You can come alone or bring the entire family. To learn more on RSVP, you can go to www.radio.com, click on the events tab, or just go to facebook.com/wwradio. You can click on the events tab and get more information there. And whether you're coming to a meet of the month with us on one of our group cruises, we'll take going on the Treasure in February for WDW Radio's 20th anniversary, or Adventures by Disney, or you're just planning your own trip to Walt Disney World, Disneyland, or any destination on the planet, go and visit my trusted, recommended for nearly 20 years partner, Mouse Fan Travel. They handle the planning so you can focus on making memories, like we talked about this and last week. They offer free vacation planning services with more than 20 years of experience creating incredible, memorable vacations because they treat you like a member of their family. It's who I use. It's who I recommend because it's who I trust. And you can visit mousefantravel.com for a free, no obligation quote today. And as always, my friend, and you are my friend, whether we have met yet or not, all I ask is that if you like the show, please help spread the word. Leave a review over on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Share a link to this or your favorite episode on social. Better yet, text a friend that you think might enjoy this episode. Share the link with them directly. And finally, and most importantly, thank you for your love and your support and your friendship. I hope that you have an amazing day today, an even better tomorrow, and that you always choose the good for yourself and be the good. Set an example and create a ripple effect for others. I love and appreciate you. Have an amazing week. So until next time, see ya.
Hi, Lou. This is Rich McNana calling from Westfield, New Jersey. I haven't called in a while, but I'm always listening. As in past years, I wanted to thank you and the crew for your coverage of this year's D23 convention, from the live feed during the event to the two follow-up podcast episodes. I really think you did a typically complete job highlighting and analyzing all of the exciting announcements that were made, especially the ones affecting Disney World specifically. And as always, you did it in a fun and really grounded way. So in that vein, I wanted to add how much I appreciate the way you handle these quote-unquote controversial theme park changes in stride and with perspective, noting that for, like, all of the losses, there are potentially wonderful gains for us fans. I think this is the epitome of choosing the good, as you say, and frankly, the reason you're my favorite Disney voice out there. So all this said, your reporting combined with your positive attitude have inspired me to go on a little adventure. Since we should accept that Disney experiences come and go, we should take advantage of attractions like that we like or have always wanted to try while they're still around, right? Instead of bemoaning them when they're gone. Well, ever since I was a little kid, I've dreamed of scuba diving at Epcot's The Seas Pavilion. As I have never actually scuba dived, let alone be certified, I've enrolled in a scuba certification class near my home, and I'm going to schedule a dive quest slot at Epcot within the next year because you never know when an experience will fade into lost attraction land like Tom Sawyer Island. I just hope I make it in time before the press release that it's closing. So anyway, thanks for the continued great times and inspiration. As always, we all love your show. Peace. Keep doing a great job.
Hey, Lou, Giovanni Palladino. Hope all is well. Listening to all this dialogue and back and forth regarding Tom Sawyer Island and Rivers of America, I look at it from a different angle. I put my architect and planning hat on, and I know there's a lot of comments about Walt always talking about how the parks would change, but there's also comments from Lou or from Walt that talked about preservation and things worthy of preservation. And if you start to really understand of what's happening and where they're placing Cars Land, I think they're missing the essence of what Walt would have wanted, and that's storytelling. You know, what's the story now? The idea of going from Adventureland to Frontierland, or the other way from Liberty Square through the Hudson Valley through the Haunted Mansion, and again going west through Rivers of America. I think that part of it is being lost and it's not being told. That storytelling part. There was always this focus on the setting, sight lines, terminating vistas, and the story in general. And I think if you had to defend your position, if Walt was sitting across from you and you're presenting this project, how would you defend it? Is it defendable? Is it something that Walt would want based on the context of everything that he always wanted? How does it fit into the neighborhood? How does it fit into the story? I think that's what's missed. I don't think Tom Sawyer Island in particular is that critical, but I think the Rivers of America is a very important part of our history and how we were built, how we built this nation through our rivers, the Hudson River, the Mississippi. It tells such an important story, and it's a great green space within Magic Kingdom itself. And to lose that would be the equivalent of going into Central Park and saying, hey, look, there's some great land here. You know, we could really build something really valuable and stay within the confines of the city, and let's build there. And I think that's a mistake. I really do. I think that's an honest mistake. I think they're not looking at it from that context. I think it's so easy to pigeonhole it, put it where they think it needs to be, and disregarding the story. Right? You told the story so great in your podcast. How do you transition now from one part of the park to the other? Or are they just giving up on that altogether? That's fine. I can understand a lot of kids don't know who Tom Sawyer is. Maybe they don't even know what American history is. But just because new generations have forgotten, instead of us teaching them about it, we shouldn't just throw it out. We should work on ourselves and telling the story and making sure we explain history. Because using that logic someday, somebody might say, you know what, kids don't know who Cinderella is. Why keep the castle? Let's get rid of it. Land's too valuable. We could put an awesome roller coaster there. That's my point. I know I'm not making sense over the phone because this is a conversation to go back and forth.
Hey, Lou. Brian from St. Augustine, Florida. The kids and I were just listening to the latest podcast of you and little Timmy Foster about the sounds, the iconic sounds in the park. And the one sound that we were talking about discussing is in Epcot at Club Cool. It's the sound that everyone gets when they fall victim for the first time of the mighty Beverly. Every single time when the kids and I go to Epcot, we have to play a game of rock, paper, scissors, and whoever loses has to get a shot of the Beverly. And it's always super entertaining to watch somebody who gets it the first time and you hear that gag when the Beverly strikes. She's a force to be reckoned with. So that was one that we were discussing. So appreciate all you guys do. Keep it coming, and hope you have a great rest of your week.